Hello and welcome to the Interfish Podcast, where we bring you the week's most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm editor Drew Cherry, joined today by senior business reporter Rachel Sapin. We are going to be talking about a new story that just was published in The New Yorker from journalist Ian Urbina and the Outlaw Ocean project that he heads. We're going to have Ian on the podcast a little later to talk about that. First up, though, we're going to talk a bit together, Rachel and I, about what we think some of the impact might be from this report. Among the allegations it details are forced labor in the China seafood processing sector, in particular related to North Korean employees. Once again, the project has linked seafood companies in the West to the plants that are using this labor. And so there's been a lot of fallout and will be much, much more. Rachel, you've been covering this story since the first investigation came out from Urbina and his Outlaw Ocean team. What was the initial reaction when the story came out last fall about Uyghur forced labor in the seafood processing chain?
Yeah, I think it just hit the seafood industry, you know, like a bomb, to be honest. I think everyone was, you know, checking to see if they were on communication lists on the Outlaw Ocean website, where they're publishing, you know, these transparent email chains, basically email communications between staff at Outlaw Ocean and largely company media representatives that are responding, you know, to this four-year investigation of the labor involved in producing seafood that goes from China into the United States. And that is a very murky area to begin with. So yeah, I think the best way to describe it is kind of like this bomb being dropped, and you know, every seafood company has just been really in reaction mode since.
And the U.S. government, some lawmakers have taken or at least called for action. And is there any sense that there'll actually be any particular traction on that? And did that play, do you think, a role in the Russian seafood ban that we're experiencing now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this the Outlaw Ocean reporting really fueled a lot of the legislative actions we're seeing by U.S. lawmakers, largely from Alaska, but it is spreading to other lawmakers having interest in the United States. But yeah, I think just those lawmakers really having kind of a platform to advocate, you know, issues they've been seeing with Russia for a long time, because Russia's had that ban on imports of seafood into the U.S. since 2014. And, you know, Alaska lawmakers in particular have wanted the U.S. to do something about that when Russia can otherwise import seafood into the United States via China in part. And I think that this Outlaw Ocean reporting just kind of gave them more fuel to work on some legislative actions. The Alaska congressional delegation really wanted to pursue for probably even 10 years before this reporting came out.
Yeah, I mean, I find it really interesting. The latest report, which we'll talk with Urbina about here later in the podcast, was in many ways, I thought, more devastating than the first story about the Uyghur forced labor. It's about North Korean forced labor. But, you know, I'm very curious what the reaction is going to be from companies, because it's such a complicated supply chain, and it's so embedded in how seafood gets to our plates now. By that, I mean China. A huge volume of the seafood that we import in the United States and as well as in Europe comes via China. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see if companies actually step up and do anything. Some already have by dropping ties with suppliers, but I wonder if this is going to have any kind of lasting change. And I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's the question we all have, right? Because I think, you know, Outlaw Ocean talks about that a lot in this reporting, is what can be done if these audits of companies in China and how their workers are treated are kind of this black box, you know, how do we address that? And I think that's going to be probably the focus of U.S. seafood companies going forward, that really want to work on this issue, is how can we, you know, have our supply chain actually transparent? How can we know what's actually going on with seafood that's being processed in China, and that workers are being treated fairly and humanely? And yeah, I think it's just a big looming kind of question we all have. But I think it's really cool that Outlaw Ocean really is getting the industry thinking about it, getting us as a trade press thinking about it. And, you know, they're important questions to ask, whether we can answer how this is all going to get resolved right now or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what's been interesting for us kind of as a reporting team is we've been doing this a long, long time. And it is interesting how the Chinese processing sector just kind of becomes a sort of like step along the chain of how seafood gets to people's plates. And it's kind of, I think, because it's such an expected and natural part of how seafood has been processed over the past few decades, that it almost becomes uninteresting. It's kind of like, oh yeah, and then you get audited, and oh yeah, then you process your fish in China. But I think that, as you said, it sort of prompted us to say, wait a minute, let's understand this a little bit better. Let's understand who the companies are. I absolutely did not know the names of the companies that they were working with. A couple of them maybe sort of rang a bell, and I could name a very small handful of companies in China that process. And that says something. I mean, these are major, major companies. In the spirit of transparency, like, everyone should know who these companies are. If you're proud of your supply chain, you should be able to say, yeah, this is who we, you know, this is who produces our products.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel the same way. I didn't know the names of any of these companies. I'm still learning about a lot of them and about some of the human rights issues in China. And you're absolutely right. It's definitely been something we've kind of skirted over when talking about, you know, transparency and sustainability in the supply chain. And I think it is something that the seafood industry, it's not going to go away, even if, you know, this kind of global reporting project turns elsewhere. You know, this is something that at this point lawmakers are focused on. We are in a kind of trade, it just seems like a tense trade kind of time with China and Russia, which I think is going to fuel more looking into these issues. And seafood, you know, is implicated in the trade from China and Russia as a global commodity. So yeah, I think it's not going to go away, and we probably do need to learn the names of these companies and, you know, what's actually going on as much as we can at them.
Yeah. And there are, I think whenever we're talking about having products processed in China, that's going to come with a certain amount of risk and a certain amount of understanding that there are things that that you are not allowed to do as a citizen of the People's Republic of China. And that's something that has to be expected if you're going to do business in China. Now, that said, I do think there are companies that are treating their workers fairly, that have probably some reactions and ways to document, hey, look, we are doing it a particular way. We, you know, in a way that meets Western standards, maybe. But if you are using those companies, if there are companies out there that are doing it, again, in to actually make that known, to have those companies be a more visible part of the supply chain, is only going to improve it for everybody. The longer it's sort of these questions about who does what and who it is that's processing, and you've never heard of the name, you don't know who the ownership is, as long as it's not transparent, I think the seafood industry is going to have a really, really hard time saying, hey, I have a transparent, traceable supply chain for my fish. And that's at the heart of providing a product that people can stand behind, is being able to say, this is where it's been. This is who's producing it. This is who's processing it. Hey, we're proud of this supply chain.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. I think we are going to see some language changes, right? And that has been an issue for seafood for a while. What is making it transparent? How do you know the audits are working? You know, we've seen lawsuits on that front far outside of Outlaw Ocean. So I think I agree with you. I think it's just opened up kind of a whole new era of, you know, how are we going to actually define traceability and follow through on kind of marketing commitments that say this seafood, you know, was sourced without slave labor. And I'm also fascinated to see what China is going to do in response. You know, are we going to have companies in China responding to this and seeing impacts to their, how they are staffed or to their sales or how they are viewed in particular by US consumers from this. I'm just really interested in that too, because I feel like we've just kind of had one side and maybe there's more to this story that we don't know yet either.
Thanks, Rachel. Well, joining us now is Ian Urbina. He's a journalist and founder of the Outlaw Ocean Project. Ian, thanks for joining us. The piece that came out this week in The New Yorker, the third of your series on China's seafood sector, has already caused a major impact here in the seafood world. And I think a lot of companies are wondering, what can I do? How exposed am I? And how concerned should I be about these violations happening in my supply chain? So I think there's been as much confusion as clarity for the industry. And so I'm hoping today that we can talk a little bit about what went into your investigation and just get a sense of what now are the next steps and who may step in to make something happen. So let's just start there. Tell us a little bit about how long you've been working on this particular project of investigating the Chinese seafood supply chain and kind of how you assembled your team.
Yeah, so this investigation is a four-year investigation. The reporting started about 4 years ago. Its ambition was to quite simply take a look at the largest and most consequential player when it comes to the oceans is clearly the Chinese writ large. And if you drill down on that, you're talking about the Chinese vessels, so probably distant water, high seas vessels, but also the Chinese processing infrastructure. If you take those two things together and you think about seafood as a global product, huge amounts of it is either coming off of Chinese ships and or being processed in Chinese processing plants. So that was the goal, was, well, let's look at that. And then it was even more attractive to us because China is also distinctly opaque. And so as an investigative shop, we were even more interested to see if we could add value by shining some light in that dark space. And that's why we began heading out to sea and reporting on this about three and a half years ago.
So tell me about the team on the ground there in China, because you just mentioned it's so opaque how the supply chain works, even to people in the seafood industry that are using it. So how do they go about understanding the conditions in the factories? What tools did they have at their disposal, and what was that process like for them?
You know, I'll often take two steps back to take three steps forward, so bear with me as I do that. Two steps back, we're talking about a series here that thus far has three large stories. The first story was a look at the on-water concerns and opaqueness and human rights and illegal fishing related to the vessels on the water. The reporting approach for that was distinct. It involved going to sea, you know, eight reporting trips. I do all the at-sea reporting and actually getting on Chinese vessels and taking a look at the supply chain disconnects and the human rights issues and IUU issues. The second story was a look at Shandong province and quite specifically a certain demographic of workers in the processing plants there. This was a look at Uyghur or Xinjiang workers. The sort of ground game, if you will, there in Shandong province was difficult. We as an organization, the Outlaw OSHA Project, have no full-time salaried staff in China. So we have a lot of folks that we hire on a contract basis for one investigation or for a specific job within investigation. When it came to looking at the Shandong province factories and trying to investigate the presence of Xinjiang workers, which, to remind your listeners, are categorically defined as forced labor under U.S. law, and basically simply trying to see, are there Uyghurs, these type people in these plants? That was a combination of direct sort of boots on the ground hires where we teamed up with investigators, some of whom I've known, you know, going back to my days at the New York Times, others that we met and vetted more recently. Those folks on the ground were doing multiple things. One, they were helping us connect the supply chain dots. So when the fish comes out of the water, or the squid in this case, and it goes on a refrigeration vessel back to port, once it gets to port, the hardest link to make is moving it from the ship to the processing plant. You really probably need folks that are doing a follow the trucks type of reporting. They have eyes on site, because otherwise it's hard using data or open source, you know, social media videos or whatever, to actually know whether this specific seafood got to this plant and that plant has Uyghur workers. So we had folks doing direct surveillance of the ports and following trucks to connect the dots to the plants. And then we also used tactics of a large staff of Chinese language folks to be helping us look through thousands upon thousands of hours of social media posts. So these are videos on Douyin, which is Chinese TikTok, or Bilibili, which is like YouTube, or WeChat, or various platforms where a lot of average folk, you know, are putting up mundane, sort of banal videos of themselves at work or at home or whatever, and mining that source, knowing how to do that and looking for evidence that would indicate the answer to your question, are there Uyghurs in that plant? So that's really what we did for that second story. And then the third story was a similar model, a little bit more difficult, but it was a turning of the lens to a different province, Liaoning province, up near the North Korean, over near the North Korean border, and looking at, are there North Korean workers in the processing plants there in China? Because again, under U.S. law, that demographic of workers categorically defined as forced labor. And so similar sort of assembling of a team in various places, some folks in China, some folks in South Korea, folks in North Korea, a whole bunch of different folks that we use to piece together the information that answers the question, you know, whether and which plants have North Korean workers.
So, Ian, for those that haven't read this story, and I recommend that they do, tell us about some of the conditions in these factories that your team found and that you found in your reporting.
Yeah, I mean, the common, so again, if you think of this in your head as a map and you're trying to keep track of all these Chinese names, Shandong province, this is a coastal province. It's on the far opposite side of the country from Xinjiang province, which is where Uyghurs are. A bunch of the factories we were looking at were in Shandong province. The other huge cluster of factories were in Liaoning province. The workers to remember here are Uyghur workers who are being transferred over 2,500 miles across the country by the state without, you know, any say as to whether they want to go or not. This is forced labor transferred into Shandong province. Those workers are largely male. They are sent across the country by order of the government. If they refuse that order, their families are often put in internment camps. So the captivity and forced labor begins before they get on the bus or train or plane. Then when they're at the plants in Shandong province, you know, these are locked facilities. Those folks are kept under close watch, those folks being the Uyghur workers, There's not freedom of movement. There's not freedom of speech. You know, these sorts of norms. These are law. You know, and again, anywhere you go, but China included. You know, seafood processing plant at work is hard work. These are long days and repetitive motions, pretty grueling conditions. They live on site on the compounds. Then now move over to the workers in Liaoning province. These are the North Korean workers. Those are mostly women. They're also transferred by their state. In this case, North Korea transfers them into China in a cooperation with the Chinese government. Those women are sent into the factories. For many of the North Korean women, they're delighted to have the jobs because what they can earn is much higher salary than they ever could access back home. They get sent in there. They're also kept in very locked down facilities, guards, you know, tall walls, barbed wire, the whole. The conditions are even more brutal, because of the power dynamic of these being all women and transport labor. So what we found was widespread sexual abuse, but also very, very closely watched clusters of workers. Again, 20-hour days, 15-hour days, you know, some of them, you know, only get one day off a week, if that. Reports of violence, you know, beatings of staff. If they are allowed to leave the compound, the North Korean women's here I'm talking about, these are on chaperoned trips to town. They're not allowed to talk to Chinese locals, are not allowed to talk to reporters, obviously, or NGOs or anyone else. They're taken to shop and get some stuff and then taken back to the facility. And in the case of the specific North Korean women that we dealt with, this is a COVID period, so things were even more tough because COVID locked the border. So some of these women expected to be, you know, sent abroad for a year, 2 years, were stuck there for upwards of 4 years. There are still some workers that are still in the country that we interviewed. Still in China. So really, really brutal conditions.
Who owns these companies, these processing companies? Part of the investigation, part of the fallout for the seafood industry has been a lack of understanding or knowledge about who's actually processing this fish for major companies. Who owns them?
Well, it's a huge industry. And so when you speak in generalities, you're going to get stuff wrong. But in general, these companies are Chinese companies. And they are in partnerships, supply chain partnerships with non-Chinese players. So Western, European, Canadian, American companies. Now, to get a little more technical, you know, the companies that own the processing plants are sometimes mega companies like the Chisan Group that own processing plants, they own cold storage facilities, they own refrigeration vessels, and they own fishing vessels. And they have their tentacles, if you will, in lots of different parts of the supply chain. Other companies, Chinese companies, are partly state-owned, right? So China National Fisheries Corporation owns processing plants and vessels and reefers. It's a state-run company, so this is a different breed of institution than you or I are used to. And then still others are partially owned in a more formalized partnership with non-Chinese players. So there's some buy-in by Western players into a partial ownership of the companies. To your second point, what's not typically known, and your column recently really said it better than I've seen said before, there has been a willful ignorance by the beneficiaries of these supply chains where they may know in general that they have six plants that they're tied to in China, but they don't probably know their names, and they probably don't, and they certainly don't, most likely don't know the conditions in those plants. And they probably don't even know whether much of what they get from those plants is actually from those plants, because especially post-COVID, there were problems in the supply chain where there were shortages of tonnage, of a certain this or that, and spot markets emerged where if a certain Western buyer needed X amount of Y type seafood, but the Chinese processing plant couldn't produce that much, then that Chinese processing plant or the labor or the sort of spot market broker in the middle said, okay, we need to top up, and so turn to other places to bring in some extra of that certain type of seafood so that we can fill this order on our deadline. And there's a lot of that going on. If you get people to be really candid with you about how things actually work in China, not only do we not have eyes into the plant and do Western buyers not know the name of the plant or what's going on in there, they actually don't really understand or care to keep track of how much of their product is coming from sources other than that plant, even though it's routed through their said plant.
But there are auditors on the ground, or at least third-party auditors. And this is the part that I think for the seafood industry is confusing, or maybe there is a bit of a tendency to say, well, this wasn't my fault, it was an auditor's fault. What's breaking down in the auditing process? You mentioned the Marine Stewardship Council, which of course is more focused on auditing the sustainability of the resource. However, there has to be a lot of failures along the way. And so why the auditors clearly need to be audited.
Yeah. So I think, like, again, your audience, your listenership is a much more savvy crowd, but just to take it, you know, they know all of this, but to take it to the average layman's understanding is to first say, okay, let's divide the category of auditors into two types. There are those auditors who generally are looking at hygienic and illegal fishing and ocean sustainability and marine issues and sort of traceability concerns. Okay, that's one type of auditor. Marine Stewardship Council is the sort of big name in that universe. And then there are this other category of auditors that are social auditors, which is to say they focus on labor concerns. Okay, now there is overlap between these auditors and the audits they conduct. So for example, with Marine Stewardship Council, they're quick to emphasize that they specialize in the marine issues, the sustainability issues, and they don't claim to do audits or have any say in the labor issues. However, if you look closely at what they do claim, that when they provide a clean bill of health to a brand, part of what they require for that, you know, report card with A's on it is a prerequisite social audit or external audit that verifies that the labor conditions have passed muster. So in Marine Stewardship Council's very labeling and public face, they are overlapping quite decidedly with social audit issues and claiming that to get their approval, there needs to be some labor, external labor review. Okay, so that makes them a little bit on the hook here. But let's not beat up just on MSC. So in general, the auditing industry, the players who actually do this work in the world, you know, whether it's, you know, bananas or computer chips or t-shirts, the marine auditors are really focused on food safety and illegal fishing issues, and they have folks in the plants and they're checking in various ways that the supply chain, you know, the questions of, do we know for sure that that fish is actually what it's being labeled as? Is that really tilapia? Do we know what ship that came off of when it got here? Do we know that the actual cargo that came from that ship and that refrigeration vessel and that's bound for Walmart or Tesco or whatever is not being swapped out by stuff that came from someone else? These are the sorts of questions that they're asking. And there are lots of flaws even in that universe, right? Their claims to know that the stuff that they know what ship it came off of and whether that ship was actually not engaged in illegal fishing are suspect. And that's something we went sort of to great lengths to try to show where the gaps even in that claim is. Now, on the labor side, those auditors, okay, now you have to pause and think about China. Okay, so there are certain, the sort of Faustian bargain that the industry's been making for a long time, and many industries and many NGOs and newspapers and everyone else, is if you go into China and are going to operate in China, you have to play by their rules. And there are certain unspoken and spoken rules of things you can't discuss, things you can't do, or else you're going to get kicked out of the country. It's just an open secret. And a lot of companies and industries and newspapers and everyone else, NGOs and ocean advocates have decided to take that deal, and they've gone in there. But it comes at a cost, such as you can't generally expect, there may be exceptions, but to do unannounced audits of a plant, show up unannounced and then ask questions. Do you have Uyghurs? Do you have North Koreans? You know, you can't expect to do independent interviews with workers in a native language that they speak apart from authorities being in the room, whether the authorities are plant operators or law enforcement or security services. These are all things that just don't, generally speaking, fly in China. And God forbid you actually find problems. You're an auditor and you want to do your job, of which there are many folks, and you're in China and you find some really worrisome things, and you're going to write up a report that says, hey, we've got child labor there, or we've got Uyghur labor there, we've got North Korean, and we've got women who haven't been allowed to go home, or we've got wage theft. If you find those things and you write them up, you have another structural problem as you, the auditor that works for SGS or whoever you work for. When you hand that report over, remember that you've been hired by the company that is sending you in there. So there's a sort of conflict of interest in the very design of the auditing structure, where the people paying for them to do the service are the people that they're reporting on. So that's another problem that probably gives pause to whether you want to say something that's highly critical of the person who's paying your bill. And then furthermore, if you write that up, are you going to be able to go to that factory again? Or are you, as auditors, going to be kicked out because the Chinese authorities say, you can't be saying that. You can't be writing that up. And you're not going to get access after that. These are the huge existential problems that I think the industry is going to have to confront if they're really honestly wanting to figure out whether they can stay in China, and if so, how they could possibly stay in China and not have another series like this in 3 years.
So talk to us a little bit about the reporting process. I mean, you on the Outlaw Ocean site, you publish some of the exchanges with companies. I'm curious about that process and what surprised you, interested you about the process of how the seafood companies responded or how the retailers responded as these investigations rolled out.
Well, so the process was one that we essentially decided at the outset of this investigation that we were going to try to abide by certain ground rules. One, we were not going to go off record with these companies. We were not going to engage in ex parte conversations, if you will. So we were going to try to be in writing and on record at all times so that we could then put it all up on a searchable website, the discussion tab. And that was a huge undertaking. Two of my 10 staff just work on that, you know, but it was really a valuable experiment for a bunch of reasons, which I'll go into. But essentially, so that meant reaching out to, I think, what's over 250 different companies, NGOs, state agencies, federal agencies, and saying, look, here's what we found, here's how we found it, and here are our questions for you. The vast majority of those interlocutors just stonewalled us, you know, and refused to engage at all, just never replied, which wasn't shocking. It was very frustrating. And some of the biggest players, even to this day, biggest brands, biggest seafood companies, biggest grocery store chains have continued to simply not answer any questions. And that's a sort of duck, and as I see it, it's a duck and cover. If you can wait these guys out, these journalists out, they'll go away. Don't engage and just keep, you know, doing what we're doing. And they may be right. You know, that has worked a lot. But one of the reasons we did the discussion approach was so that we could be super transparent, and we might be able to encourage other media, industry press, for example, to look at our work, you know, show our math, you know, look at what we said, look at what they said back, look at who didn't reply, because the industry folks are taken much more seriously. You, for example, are taken way more seriously by the people listening to this than me, because investors and industry folks, you know, buyers and everyone else read very closely what you're producing, not as much the New Yorker, you know. And so if we could lay out all these exchanges in a way that other journalists trusted them, then we could get other folks to continue on the story. And then the duck and cover approach doesn't work as well, because it's not going away, because the beat reporters, like you folks who really are experts, are going to stay with it. So that was an experiment, and it worked. You know, the industry folks, venues began using that in a really smart way and picking up on things. What I did, the only other thing I'll say on this is that was a little surprise, a pleasant one, was whatever was the portion of folks that stonewalled us when we published the first 10,000 word story was less than when we published the second story, and even less than when we published the third. So because of the industry press following up and really rigorously asking tough questions, because of lawmakers and NGOs and all sorts of other stakeholders running with the reporting, I think the industry players realized this isn't going away like most other stories do, and they began engaging. And so on this last round, published this week on North Korean workers, we got a lot more engagement from companies. Some companies, and not without reason, said, look, we want to talk with you, but we're not willing to do so on record. And I get why. They want to have a conversation where they could just be candid and safe and show their vulnerabilities and get our input. But I don't think that's actually in the service of the public. And so that's why we said, sorry, we simply can't do that. So we need to stay on record. We need to stay in writing. And you have to make a decision as to whether you're willing to have that be open discussion for the public to see after we publish all of our back and forth.
And I think that's a source of frustration for some of the companies, right? That that we've heard from some of the folks that are our readers is, hey, look, we were transparent, we answered the questions, we went on record, and now we're the ones whose heads above the parapet, and all these other companies, you know, not all 250 of these companies will get phone calls either from us or you. So you know, what do you say to that, to those folks that in good faith really tried to engage here?
Yeah, unequivocally, they are right. Like it is, I completely sympathize. I don't know that I have a solution, but they are not wrong in that point. It's somewhat the nature of journalism. Here's what I would say. I try whenever I'm asked, I did this in the congressional testimony, I'm doing it here. I try to be honest and open about that fact and say, Trident, Lunds, Panapesca, these are players that did exactly what you said. They were very open and candid and honest about what we brought to them. And that meant that there was more attention paid to them than Walmart or initially Cisco, who, for example, would not engage. And I don't think that's fair. But at the same time, I think with time, you and me and others who know this reporting and know the backstory will actually commend, like we are here, hopefully, those companies that have been leaders in the pack, even when it comes to the painful reckoning of having to stick their head above the parapet. They are out front, and the folks who are hiding and staying behind are probably not going to be able to stay there for very long. That's the hope I have. But yeah, other than that, I don't know what to say. If the suggestion in the complaint is, therefore, Ian, you should be willing to go off record and engage with us in a safe space that is confidential, then I say, that's where we part company. I don't agree. Having done this a long time, I don't actually think it's in the public interest nor even in the company's interest for us to engage in that, because all too often that is just an attempt by the company to sort of information gather from the reporter and damage control internally and figure out what they can do, but they don't really feel the pressure that the public brings if it's all made open and clear on a discussion tab.
To what extent do you think that that companies that you talk to were truly ignorant about what happens with their products in China when they're processed?
I think they were truly ignorant and not. So I think they were truly ignorant in the sense that I don't think many of these, and I talked to a couple of lawyers who actually counsel seafood industry on forced labor issues, and they said the same, which is that many of these folks had never heard the term Uyghur or Xinjiang. They didn't even know what the issue meant. They didn't really even understand the distinction between forced labor in the fashion of you have a person who's chained, who's in a textile plant in Bangladesh and the doors are chained, versus forced labor in a categorical like prison labor, child labor, Uyghur labor, North Korean labor. These are categorical forced labors where even if you interview the person, hey, this person's 12, but I just interviewed them and she says she's getting paid well and she's really happy to have the job and she's really thrilled. That doesn't matter. She's 12. She's a child labor, you know. So there are categorical forced labor and there's forced labor where they're unhappy workers who are having wage theft. They're different. I don't think the industry even understood those distinctions, for example. And I don't think that they really, as you in your column said, understood the reality of what can and can't be done in terms of true audits or not in their factories. I think a lot of them don't even know really the names of, and locations and how things work in their factories. Again, try to learn. Some of these companies have way better knowledge of these things because they've made efforts long before I came knocking to do this. But most of the industry, I don't think, knows much, like your column pointed out, the names of the plants, what's going on in the plants, who actually works there, what do the audits mean, and what do they not actually tell you. I don't think they know those things. Now, that's what they don't know. What they do know is this. The industry knows that if you're going into China, China's a pretty repressive, opaque place, and some dark stuff happens there. And they know that it's also a place where journalists and NGOs can't check into them. And so we in the sort of watchdog space have very little ability to check the merit of their MSC claims or their social audit claims in China because we can't get in. We can't do anything in there. So, and they know that. And if they claim they didn't know that China was those things, then that is where I don't believe them. They knew a lot of the Faustian bargain that they were taking when they go into China. And they say, look, but the savings are incredible. The efficiency is incredible. The red tape is much less than we have to deal with in the U.S. And they made a decision to go in there with some risk.
So is sort of one of the overarching points you think of your series that companies can't, that no companies dealing with Chinese processors can really count on their seafood being produced in a fair and what we would consider in the Western world a fair and legal way? Or are there companies on the ground in China that you think and that your team thinks is doing the right thing?
I probably would sidestep the framing of that question just a little bit, not because I'm being coy, but just because I don't think it gives me the multiple choice options I need to answer honestly. I think, what do I think? I think that there's... It's very difficult for companies of any industry to do business in China in a way in which they can know for sure that they're not tied to things that may be illegal or unethical, be it environmental or human rights, because China is a very tough place to ask certain questions. Do I think that that means that there are no seafood companies operating in China in an ethical way? No, I'm not saying that at all. I don't have the proof to say that. And I don't have the instinct, intuition that that would be true. But do I think that there's a big challenge in verifying that you, as an ethical CEO, know what's happening in China in all these categories, food safety and, you know, environmental standards. No, I don't. And I think that your point of going to the audits, that is a, that's really where it's at. It's not as interesting, it's sort of dry topic, but what is the industry that has emerged to ostensibly check some of those issues and provide reassurance to CEOs or to consumers? And are they selling a false bill of goods? Yeah, I think that not entirely, but I think that they are overselling a confidence level than is possible in a place like China. Do I think that other countries, Cambodia, Vietnam, you know, lots of countries outside of China have similar problems? For sure. You know, the auditing system and companies working in places outside of China have lots of similar problems. You read about them all the time.
So, Ian, when you were finished with all your reporting on this third story here, what questions did you still have? What don't you still know that you want and need to know about seafood processing in China?
I mean, well, a lot of my questions are a sort of tragedy, small t tragedy, I feel embedded in the reporting, which is, I think that all discussion is focused on the easier end of the supply chain, which is the on-land stuff. And what's gotten overlooked is the offshore stuff. So what's happening on the vessels themselves is still, I mean, been working on that since 2014. And all of the discussion now is about what's happening in the processing plants. And there's very little discussion happening about, you know, how are we going to create an oversight, regulatory, governmental, market-based auditing certification system that can reassure all of us that bad stuff isn't happening on or by the vessels? Well, that's still the question that we're seeing the least progress on, because it's so tough. So that is one huge realm of questions that I haven't seen pushed enough. All the focus has been on the easier categorical stuff, Uyghurs, North Koreans, and those aren't easy, but it's focused there. I think there are lots of other categories, Tibetan labor, prison labor, child labor. I mean, just run the gamut and ask the question, like, do we know there aren't those in that plant? And then chase it down. We didn't touch those other sorts of categorical worries that you might have in a place like China. And then the other non-labor human rights issue is the supply chain traceability questions of, you know, there are these claims through the certification bodies like MSC or Aquaculture Stewardship Council that they are providing reassurance that we know the bouncing ball from dot to dot to dot of the handoff of seafood from bait to plate is real. But if you really, really hover that camera, the slow motion camera over the bouncing ball, there are these invisible moments in the many handoffs that make you wonder about the legitimacy of those reassurances. Like, it came from these ships, but it, you know, some one small example you know well is like Company X says, we know that we get our stuff only from these six vessels. But then if you actually go look at it, those six vessels are handing all their stuff off to a refrigeration vessel. And if you look at the nitty gritty on how they actually bundle the stuff together, whether it's pollock or squid or tuna or whatever, how they bundle the stuff together and then hand it over to the refrigeration vessel, and then it gets handed over to the truck and port, and then it gets handed over to the processing plant. There are a lot of gaps there where it becomes less believable that they even know what vessels those came off of. And there may be 12 other vessels that are funneling into their supply chain. And those 12 invisible vessels are doing lots of dark stuff, captive labor, or invading other countries' waters or whatever. And so that's a whole non-human rights issue that I also still think there needs to be a lot of questions asked.
So let's put ourselves in the shoes of a seafood buyer or a processor. And I truly have concern about what I've read in these stories. I truly have concerns about the companies I'm working with in China. Now, if I drop a supplier, have I actually really solved anything beyond kind of absolving myself of the guilt of that particular supplier? And part one of that question, and part two of that question, then what should seafood companies be doing in the face of all this?
Yeah, so my answer, humbly, to the first question is no. I think it's a good start. You're doing a lot better than your peers by at least taking the first action of kind of triaging the wound, right? But you're not actually getting to the source harm, the disease, you know, the root cause. And the root cause isn't located at that one plant. It's located at the mechanisms you thought were preventing you from getting ill in the first place. Sorry to push this metaphor. But so if a company says, okay, we've severed ties with this one plant, the questions I would ask are, well, wait, how many other plants do you have in China? And what are you doing to check that they don't have the same problem that we were able to identify in this one plant? We don't have access to your supply chain. So we had to do this over 4 years and all sorts of crazy tactics to get a little window into your supply chain against your wishes. You have access to your supply chain and you have leverage over your partners who you're making money with. So no one better than you to be able to actually like look at how many total plants do we have and what are the core problems that caused us to overlook this issue in the first place. So yes, I'd say severing one relationship is not going to solve it. What should they be doing? Just that, you know, a real reckoning with the cause of the oversight and looking at how is auditing, whether we're doing it in-house or we're using some external firm, flawed? What questions are they not asking? What questions should they be asking? And can they even ask those questions in this political climate, in this security climate that is this country? And how do we need to rewrite the rules of that if we want to stay? That's what I would say.
Rachel, any final thoughts or questions for Ian?
I guess just where do you go next, Ian, in terms of is this kind of something where we're going to see updates every, you know, couple of weeks or months? I know you update the conversations, but is it a project where you want to keep that transparency going in terms of the stakeholder discussions and pushing the issue in Congress?
Yeah, well, first of all, Rachel, your coverage has been great. And again, I can't thank through you and Rachel and, you know, kind of your publication for really doing good journalism alongside. I think to answer your question, Rachel, methodologically will continue. So the things that we thought were really helpful and effective in this project. So the bait to plate tool on the website is an attempt at connecting the supply chain dots from start all the way to the brand name that folks know. And that takes a lot of effort. And it's very, very complicated, but it's really valuable if you want to equip the public and law enforcement and companies to do something here. You've got to connect those dots, or else it's just another sob story about something bad that happened in one isolated place. It doesn't connect to the buyers. So we're going to keep doing that as best we can for every story. The discussion thing, tool, tab is also probably something we're going to double down on. And we have another investigation coming on a different topic, different country. But we're doing it for that there too, because I think it really does help empower other reporters to check our work and decide if they want to continue on with us. And then the solutions thing we built is my humble attempt to not just be a bummer, you know, like saying all that's bad, but not offering any insight on what could be fixed and how. I don't think it's my role to offer the specific solutions, but there are a lot of smart people. I don't have to agree with any of them. It's not it doesn't matter, but academics and advocates and industry experts like you guys and other reporters. And so with the solutions tab on the website, we try to report that out and sort of say, okay, what do these folks say should be done? And what do those folks say? And put it all in one place so that when folks ask us that question, we can say, okay, listen to what we collected from the experts on that issue. We're not going to give you our answer because we don't really deserve to be answering that. We can just tell you what we definitely know is broken. So those three things, I think we're going to keep going. And then, you know, the general topics of these categories of concerns, whether they're China tied or not China tied. China's such a big player that they pop up in every story. So I don't think we'll cover this as a beat. We might have one more story in big story in this series. We're still deciding. But those tools and that approach and those issues will remain the same.
Well, thanks again so much for joining us, Ian.
Thanks, Drew.
Folks, that will wrap up this episode of the IntraFish podcast. Remember that you can find our coverage 24/7 on intrafish.com. You can sign up for our newsletters there. If you're a subscriber, you can get alerts on all the topics that matter to you. And don't forget, we also have an app and a podcast, which you're listening to. Don't forget to subscribe so that every time you put out a new podcast, it'll get pushed directly to your phone. All right, folks. Thanks again. We'll talk to you next week.